This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Later in the hour, we'll hear from a group of researchers with long COVID who are doing research on themselves to try to find relief from their symptoms. Plus, a new study on bird calls. But first, it was President Trump's first week back in office, and along with a number of executive orders, the new administration has imposed a range of restrictions on the Department of Health and Human Services, including the National Institutes of Health. Here to get us up to speed is Casey Crownhart, senior climate reporter at the MIT Technology Review. Welcome back to Science Friday, Casey.
Thanks so much. Always great to be here.
Casey, what is happening?
All kinds of things are happening. Mass confusion is happening. So like you said, the Trump administration imposed new restrictions on the NIH. That includes a suspension of all travel, a pause on all external communications out of the agency, and it's also being affected by a government-wide hiring freeze. And researchers are saying that this sort of disruption can have ripple effects that slow down the pace of research. You know, the NIH is responsible for all public health and biomed research for the government. So this could have long-ranging effects, depending on how long this all lasts.
I'm reading that it's also some grant-making operations. Have you heard anything about that?
Absolutely. So, I mean, it really ranges from, you know, researchers aren't able to travel to conferences, groups that would meet to approve grants aren't meeting. There's really like a range of things that this is affecting at the agency. One thing that really surprised me was, you know, we were expecting reports on the H5N1 bird flu outbreaks this week, and now it's not clear when those reports are going to be published.
Do you have a sense of how unusual this is? I mean, does this typically happen when a new administration takes over?
Some section of this is pretty common. So like a short pause on communications has happened in the past when a new administration takes office. But researchers are saying that kind of the scope of this is pretty unusual. So the travel pause, for example, isn't very common. It's also not totally clear how long this communications pause will be in effect. So it's definitely a little bit out of the ordinary for an administration taking over.
How are scientists reacting?
There's a lot of concern. Like I said, part of this depends on kind of how long this will last. But one researcher, for example, called this devastating in a story in Science magazine. You know, all of these young researchers just trying to do science and communicate that science to the public, they're really nervous about what the future might hold here.
What's the impact or the potential impact on science and scientists?
I think that pauses and interruptions like this can have long-ranging effects on science. So the NIH does research on things like, you know, biomedicine and public health. And so, you know, this could slow down our understanding of important public health phenomenon. Like, you know, we talked about bird flu. It could also, you know, slow down advances in getting new drugs onto the market and kind of the research involved in that. So, like I said, it kind of depends on how long this lasts, but it definitely could come with ripple effects.
To our scientist listeners, we would like to hear from you on this. If you have been affected by what's happening at the NIH, please give us a call, 646-767-6532, or you can email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. Casey, let's also briefly touch on some of the executive orders that relate to climate and energy.
Yeah. So Trump signed 26 executive orders on his first day in office, a whole range of topics. One of the ones that I was, you know, watching the most closely was one that Trump signed to pull out of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. That's the international treaty that aims to limit global warming. That wasn't a big surprise. Trump pulled out in his first term as well. Another big one in the world of science, Trump also signed an executive order to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization. That's the U.N. agency that really works on public health. So that could have ripple effects around the world as well.
We'll be following this. Let's turn to a story you wrote recently about nuclear power and how we're at a tipping point for it. Tell me what you found.
Yeah, I think 2025 is going to be a really important and exciting time for nuclear energy. Nuclear is, you know, a really big chunk of how the world gets electricity, especially electricity that doesn't come with huge amounts of greenhouse gas emissions attached. And what we're seeing this year is that advanced reactor technology could really start to kind of take off and enter this new phase. Most nuclear reactors that are on the grid today follow a pretty similar blueprint. They're really big. They use water for a coolant and low-enriched uranium as a fuel. And we're starting to see kind of efforts to go outside that blueprint, build smaller reactors, for example, that could be quicker and cheaper to build, or use different things for the coolant and the fuel. One expert that I spoke to said that, you know, this is really the time that we're starting to see paper reactors turn into, you know, real life reactors. So we could see some projects coming online in the next couple of years.
You wrote that AI is playing a role in nuclear's future, too. Tell me about it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a whole lot of different things that are contributing to rising electricity demand, but AI and big data centers are definitely expected to be a significant part of that. And one effect that we're seeing is that that is driving efforts to squeeze out as much power as we can out of existing reactors. Because, you know, those advanced projects, it'll still take years for the first of their kind to be built, not to mention, you know, enough to really make a difference on the grid. And so I'm really interested to see reactors that are having their lifetimes extended, for example, or efforts to reopen nuclear plants that have shut down, like at the former Three Mile Island nuclear plant or Palisades in Michigan. So I'm really interested to see how people, you know, like I said, try to squeeze everything they can out of nuclear reactors.
Moving on, it was a dramatic weather week in the Southeast U.S. I mean, there were record snowfalls in Louisiana and Florida. How did this happen, meteorologically speaking?
As a super weird week for weather in the Southeast. I saw that since the beginning of December, New Orleans has had more than double the snowfall of Anchorage, Alaska, as of earlier this week.
That's wild. Wait a second. Yes. Say that again.
So since the beginning of meteorological winter, which is December 1st, New Orleans has seen about 8 inches of snow. Anchorage, Alaska has seen a little under 4 inches of snow.
Wow.
Yes. Wild. So part of this is basically lake effect snow. So that kind of phenomenon that means that the Great Lakes region, the Midwestern U.S., typically sees a lot of snow. You have moisture coming off of the lakes in the Midwest. A similar thing happened with the Gulf. So we often see low pressure systems over the Gulf kind of pushing north and going along the coast. Usually that means rain, but this time there was kind of this weird confluence of an Arctic air mass coming from the north, which made it very cold. And so we saw a lot of snow in places that don't usually get it.
Wow. So not the lake effect, the Gulf effect.
Exactly.
Is this a symptom of climate change?
Oh, this is a great question with maybe a complicated answer. So we know that overall climate change causes rising temperatures. And we're seeing actually overall over the last few decades, fewer cold weather events because of climate change. But climate change isn't just global warming. Some scientists also call it global weirding. So one way that climate change could be contributing to events like this is that there's a polar jet stream, right? There's a band of these strong winds that blows west to east typically, which keeps the polar vortex, that massive cold air, up in the Arctic. Some studies suggest that climate change makes that jet stream kind of wobbly, which can disrupt that vortex and make it possible and maybe likely for that air to kind of escape and come down south like we saw this week. So it definitely kind of potentially a little bit of climate change evolved here, but it's weather and climate are also very complicated, especially in kind of rare events like this.
Okay, let's head to Los Angeles. Fires are still burning, but residents are now dealing with something else as well, the aftermath. Will you tell me about it?
Absolutely. So like you said, some of the biggest fires have been contained, although I will say that there are still dangerous fire conditions in LA. So do, you know, continue to keep watching that. But now as residents start kind of cleanup and recovery efforts, experts are warning that the ash that's left behind from these fires can be very dangerous, especially in fires that burn structures. The ash can contain toxic compounds, you know, things like asbestos and lead that are common in older buildings. Even more common materials like plastics that are all over our homes, things like batteries can, when they burn, you know, release these compounds that you really don't want to be breathing in. So if you are involved in recovery, folks should wear N95 masks and gloves and be careful around those efforts.
Does that show up on your air quality app, you know, on your weather app?
I think it's actually very difficult to measure because even small amounts of this can be, you know, dangerous or have long-ranging impacts that are kind of difficult to measure on our health. And a lot of air quality monitoring, it's difficult to pick those things up.
Let's wrap up with a refreshing dip in the sea. Tell me about this new manta ray finding.
Yes. So big mystery in science up until now has been, what in the world are manta rays' tails for?
Right, because stingrays, we know, they're a weapon.
Yes, infamously used for defense. And most other kind of, you know, sea creatures use their tails to propel through the water. Manta ray tails do neither of those things. And so researchers wanted to look into what in the world they're using their tails for. And so what they found is that their tails might be acting as antenna, basically designed to detect approaching danger.
Really? What are they sensing?
So basically the organs that are in their tails are linked to their lateral line canal. This is a common system of sensory organs in fish and amphibians that can basically detect movements in surrounding water. For most, you know, aquatic vertebrates, that is most complex and kind of developed near their head. But in some kinds of rays, that system runs all the way down their tail. And the idea, kind of the hypothesis, is that it's because a lot of rays bury their heads in the sand to eat and leave their backsides and their tails exposed behind them, sticking up in the water. So if, for example, a shark is swimming by, moving a lot of water around, that tail could kind of detect that and say, oop, time to finish up my lunch.
Wow, like a spidey sense in their tail.
Exactly.
That's a great image, too.
I know. So kind of adorable, I think, at least.
Thanks for bringing us the news this week, Casey.
Thanks so much. Always great to be here.
Casey Crownhart, senior climate reporter at the MIT Technology Review. After the break, an update on long COVID and how Paxlovid may help.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Can you believe it's been 5 years since the first laboratory-confirmed case of COVID-19 in the U.S.? Of course, that pandemic has changed all of our lives, but for the lucky ones, only in small ways. For others, COVID-19 turned them into COVID long haulers. This is a chronic condition that lingers long after a COVID infection and can reduce one's ability to live their day-to-day life. It's been estimated that about 400 million people worldwide, yes, have had long COVID, and some researchers say that number should be much higher. There's a lack of research on successful treatments for long COVID. So some scientists living with the condition have taken things into their own hands, running experiments on themselves, and joining me to talk about a recent investigation using Paxlovid are my guests, Dr. Allison Cohen, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of California in San Francisco, and Dr. Julia Moore Vogel, Senior Program Director at Scripps Research in La Jolla, California. Welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Before we just jump in, I want us to get to know you two a little better. So tell us a little bit about your research background and your experience, please, with long COVID. Allison, why don't you go first?
Sure. So I'm an epidemiologist. And before the pandemic, a lot of people had never heard of epidemiology. Now more have. That means that I study patterns of health and well-being and apply that knowledge to try to improve public health. And in particular, I've built a career around doing what's called community-based participatory research, which means that I usually work in partnership with folks who are affected by different health issues to design and conduct rigorous research that can answer the health questions that are of highest priority to them. So in the last 5 years, that's included a lot of research related to the COVID-19 pandemic and to long COVID. I've also been living with long COVID for the last 3+ years.
What's that like?
You know, there are over 200 different symptoms that folks with long COVID might have. So the experience of any given individual with long COVID may look pretty different. They can include symptoms like dysautonomia, and so that can affect circulatory system, things like orthostatic intolerance, which just makes it harder to be upright and get enough blood going to all of the different parts of your body. It can also affect fatigue. And so those are some of my primary symptoms.
Right. And Julia, what's your experience with science and long COVID?
Sure. So I'm a computational biologist by training. That means we take math, computer science, and biology together to analyze data. And after getting my PhD, I went to get an MBA. And my idea was to sort of work at the interface of science and business. I've been doing that at Scripps Research for the past 7 years, leading direct-to-participant remote health research and clinical trials. My experience with long COVID started in July of 2020. I had a pretty typical acute case where I had the difficulty breathing and the fever and all of that. And I just never got better, which is wild 4.5 years later. And for me, one of the most difficult aspects is that it's actually gotten worse year over year, and it just feels completely out of my control. The main symptoms for me are fatigue in the physical sense. I now use a manual wheelchair with a power assist in the house. And I don't know if people are familiar with that sort of wheelchair, but it's basically like an e-bike, except a wheelchair version. But I used to be a long distance runner, super active. I could work as much as I wanted, only limited by the need to sleep eventually. And now I have to be very careful about how much I work, or I trigger post-exertional malaise where my symptoms are just much worse for quite a while.
So you two, you published in the journal Communications Medicine a paper that you reported using Paxlovid to treat long COVID, right? I mean, I took Paxlovid when I got COVID for 5 days because I was in the high risk category, but you used it for much longer, right, Allison? Tell us what the normal way to use it and what you guys did.
Sure. So most of your listeners might be familiar with Paxlovid as something that is taken in the acute stage right after a known infection of COVID-19 has begun and taking a 5-day course. There have now been some studies in progress and or recently completed that have been doing clinical trials to look at extended courses of Paxlovid outside of the context of a particular infection to see if that helps people with long COVID. People living with long COVID are eager for treatments that can help with their symptoms, right? As you mentioned, we're about 5 years into this pandemic, and there are still not yet any FDA-approved treatments for long COVID. And the pace of clinical trial research can be slow. So some patients have been trying different medications themselves. And so we were just starting to hear about individuals' anecdotal experiences trying extended courses of Paxlovid. And then with my epidemiologist hat on, it seemed like that could be helpful for both the scientific evidence base and patient knowledge to systematically document these experiences. So what this paper did is talk with individuals with long COVID who had already tried extended courses of Paxlovid. So we were typically talking with them after the fact. And hearing about their experiences, all of their symptoms related to long COVID, both before, during, and after attempting this extended course of Paxlovid.
Did it help people?
Yeah, so we found that some patients reported a meaningful sustained improvement in their symptoms. Others had no improvements or only temporary improvements. And so now the big question is, who may benefit from an extended course of Paxlovid and why? But our evidence does suggest that it might be helpful to at least some folks.
Julia, you were not only a contributor on this paper, but you were one of the research participants. What was your experience with using this extended dose of Paxlovid?
Yeah, unfortunately, I was one of the ones that it had no effect for. And this was not uncommon in the group, but there could be a lot of different reasons for this that really need to be explored in further research. One idea is the dosing. My physician advised me to take half the doses. So instead of taking it twice a day, I was taking it once a day over a longer period of time. That was their strategy, but it could be that, you know, a higher dose and maybe also over a longer period of time might be better. We're still not sure whether it crosses the blood-brain barrier. There's been some studies in rats, but not in humans yet, to confirm whether the drug can get into the brain, which is where a lot of the symptoms are hypothesized to manifest. And we know from autopsy studies that the virus does make it into the brain. And then the third piece is there's also a possibility of viral reactivation. So some people with long COVID not only have have potentially issues with viral reservoirs of COVID, but also other viruses that are already in their body reactivating. So I've been confirmed to have them in a research study. And so it's possible that if those are the things driving my symptoms, then Paxlovid wouldn't be able to alleviate my symptoms. So all of this really points to the need for more subgroup analyses. That's part of what we're advocating for at this point, especially in the other trials looking at Paxlovid and trying to understand whether it's working or not for folks. And this could include things like measuring viral persistence, you know, explicitly from people's blood and tissue, and looking at other things that are happening in their samples to try to stratify the people that do respond and don't respond.
Mm-hmm. So, Julia, it's possible there is no one silver bullet because of the mixed bag of results you got here for treating long COVID.
Absolutely. I don't expect to have a silver bullet just because, as Allison mentioned, there are over 200 different symptoms that can appear in any different combination. And then the other piece about it is there are about 6 different mechanisms of what can be causing long COVID. So everyone has in common COVID as the thing that started their long COVID. However, there are so many different physiological things going wrong in different people with long COVID. They might require different treatments.
You are both part of the patient-led research collaborative, Allison. Can you tell me about this?
Sure. So the Patient-Led Research Collaborative is a group of researchers and other folks in the scientific arena who also have lived experience with long COVID. It was co-founded by folks who were part of that initial first wave of people to have long COVID. And then Julia and I have joined it more recently.
Allison, to me, it seems like it would be an incredibly frustrating position to be in where you have this background in scientific research, you want there to be more research into this thing you're living with, and the research just isn't there. So you have to do it yourself. What's it like to be in that position?
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's also a responsibility. It also feels like a worthwhile undertaking to have this deep empathy for what folks with long COVID are going through, as well as having all of these epidemiology textbooks on my bookshelf and all of that knowledge in my head in terms of thinking about, okay, how can we work at this nexus to do studies that are going to be rigorous and trusted by scientists around the world, and also research that is going to be trusted by patients all around the world and is going to be doing work that's useful for them. And given that so much of my background has been in doing epidemiologic research that is trying to directly answer questions that folks affected by certain health issues are experiencing, it was an honor that the 13 patients who were included in this case study trusted us with their time and their stories. And in doing this study in the first place, because of our own deep understanding, most of the authors involved in this paper have long COVID, there is a strong accountability that we have to this patient community.
What about any frustration? Here we're talking about the treatment side and basically throwing something on the wall and seeing if it sticks, right? What about the basic research to find out what causes long COVID? Is there frustration there too, Julia?
I actually think we've made amazing progress as a field on the basic science side. Given how short it has been from the disease starting, 5 years in research time is not that much for how much we've learned. And my frustration is mainly at this point on the lack of trials, because I think we know enough about the mechanisms of long COVID to turn the large majority of our attention to actually trying to treat it. And I know that that sense of urgency comes from my personal experience, right? You know, I have a young child, and I know every year that goes by, I am missing a lot of things in her life because of my energy limitations. And so I want to get this done ASAP. So that definitely affects how I think about the long-term basic science research that takes quite a while to deliver versus a trial that we could run today and have results on, you know, within a year.
When a trial, you're talking about Paxlovid in a larger scale.
Oh, no, I mean all clinical trials. I think that the field should be more focused on clinical trials than it is right now.
Of what? Do we have drugs that you're thinking of?
Yes. Well, so there are actually a lot of great trials going on. This is the first year that I'm excited about the slate of trials that are happening. So I can definitely list a number of them. So one looking at mitochondrial dysfunction is rapamycin, which David Petrino's group is running. And the reason that I personally feel that mitochondrial dysfunction resonates with me and how I feel physiologically, that there is just no energy to be had. I can't just push through the way I would have as a long distance runner, you know, in mile 10 of my jog. There's just nothing. So I'm really excited about something to treat mitochondrial dysfunction. There's a few looking at immunomodulation with JAK inhibitors, both the baricitinib trial by Wes Eli's group and another JAK inhibitor trial that's starting at Harvard. Another immunomodulation option is IVIG, which is being run by the NIH Recover Consortium. This one's tricky because it's not super scalable. You have to get the antibodies from people and then infuse them into other people. So it would be a difficult thing to scale, but it's very interesting to see what's going to happen for folks. And then the other mechanism that's being looked at a lot now is viral persistence, both through a few different monoclonal antibodies trials. Michael Peluso's funded by the Patient-Led Research Collaborative. Nancy Klimas is just starting one funded by the Schmidt Initiative for Long COVID and the state of California. And then there's another one in Italy that's funded by industry, all looking at monoclonal antibodies. And then the last viral persistence one is also being run by the Petrino group on Truvada, which is an HIV antiviral.
You're saying there's no dearth of trials going on.
Well, I think we are finally getting to start some trials now. However, as we mentioned before, there's going to be different things that work for different people. So we need a very large array of trials. And not all of these trials are well-powered enough that we would, at the end of the day, be able to say, okay, we can now give this drug to everyone with right. long COVID. So right. many of them are underfunded that they're, you know, like a 40-person trial, which you can't make a treatment decision for millions of people based on. So there really needs to be more funding going into these studies, hopefully from industry, philanthropy, NIH. We'll take everything we can get. And then the other piece that I haven't seen as much in terms of the trials is there are probably a lot of generics on the shelf that we could look into. However, industry isn't incentivized to doing those trials, so we really need other funding sources to be able to get those going. So, I mean, for me, I would like to see something like what we see in cancer, where there's just hundreds of trials going on, right? Because just like cancer, there are a disparate array of things happening in long COVID, and we are going to need a whole portfolio of drugs to be able to solve it for the entire community.
One last question for you, Julia. We're entering a political administration that has demonstrated sort of a lack of interest in some areas of basic research and scientific research. Do you have any fears about the future of long COVID here?
I definitely have some fears about the future of what might happen. I would really ask the administration to think about prioritizing the Long COVID Research Moonshot Act that's been introduced in Congress, which is aiming to provide $1 billion a year of funding over the next 10 years to solve this crisis. I think that it is not the time to take a pause on infectious disease research. You know, long COVID aside, seeing the H5N1 cases looming, I think there's a lot to be done in this space. And I hope that we can continue to invest in things that are good for the public as a whole and continue to maintain, you know, our nation's reputation as a leader in science and medicine.
Well, with that, I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. We've run out of time. Dr. Allison Cohen, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC San Francisco, Dr. Julia Moore Vogel, Senior Program Director at Scripps Research in La Jolla, California. Thank you both, and good luck to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
We have to take a break, and when we come back, why do bird species sound so different from one another? How audio gathered from birders around the world is helping us learn new things about bird song. Plus, recording tropical forest soundscapes, what these audio time capsules can tell us about a forest's health. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Birds are the virtuosos of the animal kingdom. I mean, they can make a remarkable range of sounds. But Why is a barred owl more of a tenor? While a cedar waxwing is more of a soprano. My next guest analyzed 100,000 bird sounds from all over the world to try to peck out some kernels of knowledge about what determines a bird's vocal range and the sounds that they make. Joining me now is one of the study authors, Dr. Zuzana Bujavalova, assistant professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, based in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, so you analyzed 100,000 bird sounds. Where did they come from?
So in this research, which was actually led by a PhD student in my lab, Satya Chandra Zagar, we analyzed more than 100,000 recordings that came from this amazing repository of bird sounds called ZenoCanto. And this repository is where anyone can upload sounds of birds that they encounter in the forest, in their backyard, or anywhere.
Wow, so these are birders who made this data set that you used.
Yes, they're birders, they're citizen scientists, they're nature lovers. Anyone can upload recordings.
And they're from around the world?
Yes, they're from around the world. They are from every single continent, biome. Obviously, there are some areas that are better represented than others, but because so many people participate, there's a pretty good coverage, actually.
So tell me what you found. Give us the bird's eye view.
The bird's eye view, yes. So Zagra found a lot of different things in terms of testing the major hypotheses about what rules the bird's sounds. One of the most important ones, and that one has been known for quite a while, is that the bigger the bird, the bigger its body size, the lower the sound it makes. We found that, yes, this relationship is true, and we're able to confirm it across all these different species, showing that really the body mass of the bird rules how deep it can go.
Which is not that surprising, right? I mean, that's often true in other animals that we might be even more familiar with, like ourselves.
Exactly. If you think of elephants having really, really low pitch sounds, as low as infrasound, and then if you think of mice making sounds at high frequencies, it's not something that surprising. But the novel thing we're able to do is to really isolate this effect and separate it, for example, from even the role of the beak size and other things that turned out to be important, like the latitude and type of habitat.
Well, let's talk about beak size. How did beak size seem to influence or correlate with the types of sounds a bird made?
As you can imagine, the bigger the bird, the bigger the beak in general. But even when we take this kind of correlation into account, still some birds might have disproportionately large beak for their size. So the beak size itself was also related to the frequency at which they make sound. Again, with bigger beaks having lower frequencies and smaller beaks being able to make sounds at higher pitch.
Can you give me an example of a bird I might know?
So for a small one with a small beak, you might know, for example, the winter wren. And for a big one, for example, all the hornbill species that are common in tropical regions are pretty big animals with even larger beaks. Coincidentally, a lot of these hornbill species are actually threatened because the beak is being targeted by poachers who use it for all sorts of different things.
What about geography? How did that play a role in the sounds that birds are making?
Specifically, the latitude at which the species occur played an interesting role. What we found was that at the equator, the bird species making sound had a smaller range. So they were, in a way, occupying a narrower bandwidth than birds at northern latitudes.
Huh. Well, why would birds at the equator have a smaller range of sounds?
This is one of the puzzles of bird songs. One potential explanation is that at the equator, there are many, many more species. And so the bird species might have to carve for themselves out a narrower niche, narrower bandwidth that they will be using so that they could effectively communicate with each other. You could think of it, for example, if you had an orchestra with lots and lots of different types of instruments at the equator, a really rich orchestra, each instrument might be given a smaller range of frequencies at which it can play so that the listeners can hear each instrument. Whereas at the temperate zones, we might have an orchestra with fewer instruments and each instrument can cover a broader bandwidth.
So basically, if you're in an environment where there's a lot of sound, you don't want to compete across a lot of different frequencies. You want to carve out your own little sound niche, frequency niche.
Yes, and this idea of species might be competing for the acoustic space was proposed already more than 30 years ago by Bernie Krause. And we looked at this question, whether this is the case, at several different ways. We looked at the latitude, and we know that at the equator there are many species. And we did find this relationship. But then Sagara also calculated for every single point for where we had recordings. He calculated how many other species are there likely to be, both for birds and frogs, so that we could see whether the species richness actually correlates with this bandwidth. And we did not find that that was the case. So it's still a little bit of a mystery why exactly this is happening across the latitudes.
You also found that on average, smaller birds had a larger vocal range, like they could hit low notes and high notes. Why would that be?
This is something really interesting, and we didn't really expect this. One of the reasons that this might be the case is that smaller birds might want to, on occasion, pretend that they're actually much bigger than they are. And the way to do this might be by lowering the frequency, so lowering the voice so that other individuals might perceive, oh, I can hear this really low pitch sound. I am about to encounter a big, scary bird, whereas actually it's a tiny bird.
Now, you don't only study birds. I understand you lead something called the Sound Forest Lab. What is that?
In the lab, we're interested in actually all animal sounds, not just bird sounds. We are using the sounds that animals make across tropical forests, but also in temperate zones, to better be able to monitor biodiversity, to understand how healthy forests are, what is the impact of different things that humans do, and all that using sounds.
Where have you recorded?
Ooh, we have recorded at lots of different places, and currently the lab is working on this Soundscape Baselands project, where we're trying to record soundscapes at the world's most intact remaining forests. So some examples are in Gabon, in Central Africa, in Ecuador, in Peru, also in Brunei, and also at one forest in Wisconsin and in Germany.
Do you go there yourself and place the microphones?
Usually what it looks like is that I go, for example, I went to Ecuador and Gabon and Peru, but there I work very closely with local scientists or community conservation practitioners or people who know the forest really, really well. And together we place the microphones and decide where should we be recording.
We've got a clip of one of your soundscapes from Borneo, the Borneo rainforest. Before we play it, what should I be listening for?
Oh, you should be trying to spot as many species as you can, or at least especially different groups of animals. One example you might listen out for is the hornbill that we mentioned earlier, a bird with a really big beak, and you might be even able to hear its wingspan. I think in this recording, you can also hear some gibbons.
Ha ha ha! Okay, so what did you hear in that?
Well, I got completely transported back to the rainforest in East Kalimantan in Borneo, and I could hear the hornbill right in the middle, this kind of almost dinosaur-like sound. You can also hear the gibbons singing, because this is early in the morning, just when they are waking up. There are lots of different bird species. I think I heard the white-rumped shama in there, and then of course kind of omnipresent background of insect noise.
Can you use sort of computer analysis or AI to pick out the different animals in there?
We are using a lot of artificial intelligence to just sift through these recordings and be able to pick up different species. So for example, for bird species and some mammals, it is quite easy to train these AI algorithms to identify them. But unfortunately, there is no machine learning approach yet that identify every single species. There is just not enough known about the different species of insects, how they sound, to be able to teach a computer to recognize them.
Hmm. We need a Merlin for bugs.
Yes, we do.
What has surprised you about some of these soundscapes that you've captured?
I'm always surprised by the soundscapes we capture. I think one surprising thing is just quite how noisy it is in the morning. And this is something that's consistent everywhere where I've been. The dawn is the time that you just can no longer sleep, which is good. It motivates me to get up and do research. But I've also been really surprised by some of the animals that just seem to be mimicking other sounds. So some of the famous ones that people might be familiar with are birds that can mimic even chainsaws. And one thing that surprised me, for example, in Gabon, was the Patinos monkey that actually sounded really like gunshots. And it even tricked our machine learning algorithms at one point, because their sounds got picked up as gunshots at first.
Really? Are you an audio junkie? Like, have you always been interested in sound?
I have been always interested in rainforests. And I've been, I mean, I grew up in a temperate forest, but I think I've always used all my senses, hearing. Also, I love the smells of forest. So not just the sounds, but I think sounds are something that is not yet fully explored, and it can tell us a lot about the biodiversity that we just can't pick up by just looking.
I was just going to ask, are there advantages of capturing sound over video?
Oh, absolutely. We have to listen. We can't just look, because just using images such as from camera trips, which is amazing, but it only picks up those animals that are big enough, that are going to pass through the field of vision of the camera. So for example, a chimpanzee moving on the ground rather than sitting up in the canopy. And also the animal has to be moving slowly enough to trigger the camera. So images may not be great for insects or really quickly flying small birds up in the canopy. Whereas with sound recordings, we can capture the animal sounds essentially regardless of the direction.
What are the occupational hazards? Have you had an animal walk off with your microphone before?
The occupational hazards, definitely. Tropical forests are pretty tough environments for recording devices. We have had elephants attack or take away the recorders from trees. We don't know if it's because it was upsetting or if they were just curious. But surprisingly, the biggest challenge is termites and ants. They just end up eating the microphone foam, straps, and pretty quickly, actually.
Do you have a soundscape wish list, a place you're dying to hear?
I have a long wish list. I just wish that we can record soundscapes in all of these intact forests, because there are so few remaining. For example, in Madagascar, those forests are disappearing pretty fast. It's just something I consider it almost as a time capsule. We can record it now because otherwise we might lose it forever.
Well, I wish you luck, and I hope to get to hear Madagascar sometime. Zuzana, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Zuzana Bujavalova, Assistant Professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, based in Madison, Wisconsin. Ira, before we go, we do have a little business to take care of, a wrong we must right.
Hi, this is Katie from Santa Barbara, California, calling with a quick comment. Ira, I know you know that the song, I Remember It Well, is not actually from My Fair Lady. It's from Gigi, of course.
Yes, I remember it well. We dined with friends.
We dined alone.
It's worth looking up the classic version sung by Maurice Chevalier and Hermione Gringold. I thought that was an amusing slip to make exactly because of the song's not quite remembering it so well vibe. Love the show, everyone, and welcome as Sci-Fry co-host, Laura.
It warms my heart to know that you remember still the way you do.
Ah, yes. I remember it well.
Ah, yes, I remember it well. And as the words came out of my mouth, I remember also that I had the wrong movie in mind. So thank you for that correction. There are so many of those plays and movies going through my head, I can't keep track of them.
That's the problem. Too many show tunes in your head at one time.
Exactly.
Katie, thank you for calling with this and giving us a chance to play show tunes on Science Friday today. Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week, including
Kathleen Davis,
Diana Plasker,
Beth Ramey,
Danielle Johnson,
Santiago Flores.
Thank you, everyone. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of this program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast. I'm Flora Lichtman. We'll see you next week. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Later in the hour, using woolly mammoths and AI to find new antibiotics. Plus, can psychology help us get through winter? But first, last Friday, just before the inauguration, President Trump hosted a crypto ball in D.C., where he and Melania Trump unveiled their very own meme coins. You may have heard about it.
President Trump and First Lady Melania launched meme coins.
The cryptocurrency world erupted into chaos as Donald Trump and Melania Trump launched rival meme coins.
Donald Trump has stamped his likeness on his own meme coin.
I am going to venture that many of us don't have a crystal clear understanding of what this is or why you'd want to make one or sell one or buy one. So up next, what is a meme coin? How is it related to Bitcoin? What do you do with them? As you can hear, I have a lot of question coins in my digital wallet, and we have just the right person to give us some answers. Liz Lopato is a senior writer at The Verge, where she covers cryptocurrency and business. Liz, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Liz, what is a meme coin? Is it a meme? Is it a coin?
I mean, maybe the easiest way of describing this is to say that it's kind of like a digital stock that tracks how popular a meme is. So unlike something like Bitcoin, this isn't really about technical innovation, and it's not meant to be something that could be used as a substitution for currency. It's mostly about going viral.
So it's like a stock in an idea or in a meme.
Yeah. So let's just start with stocks, right? You know, those track sort of the future of a company and can be used as a way of understanding how one feels about, let's say, Apple, right? If you feel good about Apple's future, you buy Apple's stock. So to sort of translate that, a meme coin can be thought of as a way of expressing an emotion about a meme with money.
Hmm.
Assume that the meme becomes more popular and thus the meme coin will go up. It's almost pure psychology. This is economics without any underlying real world assets. And so there's like a culture of gambling around meme coins, which I'm sure will just shock you. And the sort of way that this gets referred to is, I'm not kidding, Ponzi-nomics. And the idea is, like, everybody knows kind of the trajectory of how meme coins work, which is they go up in value and then they immediately, they drop very steeply. And then usually they aren't worth anything. This is just speaking generally.
That's the usually how it goes with a meme coin.
Usually how it goes.
Okay.
Not always, but very often. So the idea, if you're playing in meme coins and you're cynical, is that you buy in thinking that you will sell before the big drop off and you will make money that way.
Is anyone playing in meme coins who's not cynical?
We call them bag holders. They're the people who lose all their money.
They're stuck holding the bag.
That's right. And, you know, like, listen, there are real ideologically committed people in the crypto space, but they don't typically work on meme coins. And they refer to them as something I don't think I can say on your show.
Four-letter coins.
Yeah, that's right. And these are things that are not taken very seriously. And, you know, sort of the meme coin, if you will, is Dogecoin, which was created as a parody of cryptocurrency and then sort of took off. And you may recall, there was a period where Doge had a big run-up in value, and then Elon Musk went on Saturday Night Live.
I keep telling you, it's a cryptocurrency you can trade for conventional money.
Oh, so it's a hustle.
Yeah, it's a hustle.
Why did you say that, man?
And the value immediately plummeted. And that's kind of how these things work, right? Like, you hit the peak, and then everybody sells at once. And one of the things that's interesting about how some of these meme coins work is that many people who are getting into them, it's their first foray into cryptocurrency. And I think it's a very easy way to get burned.
So it's a hustle?
It's a hustle.
How is the crypto community reacting to President Trump's new meme coins?
Well, they're not happy about it, right? Meme coins are not universally popular within the crypto world. And I think a lot of people who are the true believers really do see the risks that are involved with them. One of my favorite things was actually I saw members of the crypto community who were blaming Gary Gensler, who is the former head of the SEC, for not having created a framework that would have prevented meme coins like this. And it's particularly funny if you are pretty deep in the finance world, because the crypto community has hated Gary Gensler for cracking down on crypto. And so to have them suddenly say, oh, he wasn't cracking it down enough, or he wasn't cracking down in the right way, is just... Sure, guys. There was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal complaining about it. Like, this is something that people who are serious about cryptocurrency feel undermines the seriousness of what they're attempting to do.
Because this is more cynical, or because this is not actually about being an alternative to existing currency, or is this about deeper ethical concerns?
That's right. And I mean, also, you know, just being blunt here, this is also potentially a route for bribing the president, right? Because who stands to benefit the most when the meme coin goes up in value? It's the person who holds the most of the meme coin, and who is that? So, you know, there are real ethical concerns here, as well as the sort of ideological concerns that come with the launch of a presidential meme coin. And, you know, there's also like the potential reputation hit that comes from a pump and dump, right? So if Donald Trump decides he wants to sell his reserves, because to be clear, only 20% of these coins are trading right now. So whatever the value is not fully diluted. If he decides he wants to sell some of those non-public coins, he can essentially tank the entire market and walk away with a lot of money, which is one of the things that famously happens with meme coins. It's called rugging, or pulling the rug out from under people.
Is that legal?
Great question. It's murky territory. And there are a number of things that go on in crypto that would not be allowed in other markets that may very well be illegal, but that are often difficult to prosecute.
You were telling me before we started chatting that crypto is inherently political. What do you mean by that?
Essentially, Bitcoin started as a way to hate the federal government with money. Bitcoin comes out of the 2008 financial crisis. It was invented in part because the Satoshi Nakamoto entity didn't trust the banks. And, you know, it was started by a group of cypherpunks who wanted an alternative to the dollar. And the dollar is actually politically incredibly important. You know, it's the world's reserve currency. It's a major source of American soft power. So creating an alternative to that, something that competes with the dollar, is a political action. Investing in Bitcoin is essentially, you know, giving the middle finger to the Fed. It's one of the reasons why you see a lot of libertarians in that space and a lot of anarchists. These are people who are not big fans of government generally and our government specifically. So, you know, in terms of the ideology involved, this isn't, in fact, inherently political. There is no way to talk about cryptocurrency without talking about politics.
Do you think meme coins fit into the same bin there, or are they different in some way?
I think they're different in the sense that they are a much smaller piece of this, right? Like, this is a very cynical way of expressing what you think the stock market is. Like, in some ways, I think that the rise of meme coins and Ponzinomics is a way of essentially critiquing the broader stock market and the broader way that we approach economics by saying, you know, actually, the stock market's a joke. Actually, it's not really worth anything. Actually, it's all, you know, a rigged game.
I mean, I've read the headlines that President Trump's coins are said to be worth billions now. How should I interpret that? Is that in real money, like that he could cash out and have?
No, is the short answer to that question. So again, I think I mentioned that this is not a fully diluted market. So if he were to try to cash out right now, the market would plunge. One of the things that happens to be true is I think 20% of the tokens are what's trading. And supply and demand sort of suggests that this is a limited supply, right? So if you add to the supply, the price goes down, the demand goes down. So if he were to sell all of his holdings right now, maybe he would make some money, but it wouldn't be that much.
Liz, what are you going to be looking out for in the next, you know, whatever, months, year in the meme coin space? Is there anything you're sort of waiting to see, something that you're waiting to see happen?
One of the things about crypto is that it is the most absurd part of the financial industry. And so there are moments where you can sort of predict what'll be happening. And so in this sense, like I said, I kind of think that all of these meme coins eventually go to zero. And I just don't know when or how quickly. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, look, we're looking at a crypto boom. Crypto was huge in the last election. The industry spent a lot of money getting pro-crypto lawmakers, including Donald Trump, elected. I think they are expecting some kind of payoff in that, you know, whether that's legislation that gives them a friendly regulatory regime or a head of the SEC who's friendlier to crypto than Gary Gensler was. One of the things that I'm trying to track is just sort of the serious piece underlying this, because the Bitcoin ETFs suggest an interest from the broader financial market in this space. And, you know, just today, BlackRock went on, I think it was CNBC, to say that they want to tokenize securities. That would be a significant change to have something as established as BlackRock operating in the crypto space in this particular way. It would bring the real financial system a lot closer to the crypto system. And the two of those things have been relatively divorced, although they have been getting closer. And like the last time we had a big crypto crash, it took out two real world banks. So, you know, I'm just watching to see where and how this develops, because obviously there is a lot of political power in play.
It's fascinating. Thank you for taking the time to explain this to us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Liz Lopato is a senior writer at The Verge. Coming up after the break, we'll take a look at AI models that are able to design proteins that don't exist in nature.
We've gone from a situation where I would say kind of we were on the lunatic fringe and everyone thought it was crazy to now kind of in the mainstream.
Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Last week, we briefly touched on a recent Nature paper where scientists unveiled new proteins that can neutralize deadly snake venom, a type of toxin found in cobras and their relatives that can be difficult to treat. A new antivenom is a cool discovery on its own, but there is a twist to this snake tail. These new proteins were designed by AI. This is a fast-growing area of research, using AI to discover or design the building blocks of drugs. Another team at Penn is using AI to search for new potential antibiotics in the genomes of extinct species like Neanderthals and woolly mammoths. I know it sounds almost too sci-fi to be on Sci-Fi, but it is happening. Here to tell us more are two pioneers in this field, Dr. Cesar De La Fuente, bioengineer and presidential associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and Nobel laureate Dr. David Baker, director of the Institute for Protein Design and professor at the University of Washington in Seattle. Welcome to you both.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.
David, you focus on designing new proteins, which I think can feel a little abstract for the non-protein designers out there. How should we think about them? How are you interested in using them?
Proteins in nature carry out essentially all the important functions in our bodies and in all living things. And they solve a really enormously broad range of problems, ranging from powering movement to thinking to capturing solar energy. So if you think about all the problems that we face today, and you know a little bit about what proteins do in nature, you sort of are brought to the conclusion that a lot of the problems that we face could be solved by new proteins. And we don't want to wait hundreds of millions of years for new proteins to evolve. And so the really exciting thing about protein design now is we can make brand new proteins, and we can make them to solve a really wide range of different problems, ranging from snake bite to completely different problems like degrading plastic or getting methane out of the atmosphere or making improved vaccines. So it's just a really exciting time now.
Let's talk about your antivenom proteins. Walk me through the process of how you got to them.
We've been designing proteins to bind to other proteins for quite a few years. In the last 3 years or so, we've developed AI methods for doing this, which are kind of analogous to the way that DALL-E, the image generator, works. So in DALL-E, you might say, generate an image of a cat sitting on a table. Instead, in the case of the snake venom, what we did was, or what Susana Vasquez-Torres, the brilliant student who did the work, did, was she took the snake venom proteins whose structures were known, and she basically told the generative AI, generate a protein which binds to this site on the venom. The generative AI then builds up a completely new protein which kind of fits perfectly against the snake venom toxin, just like a key would fit into a lock. Proteins in nature, they're encoded in DNA in our genome. So each protein in our bodies is encoded by a gene. Since the proteins that Susana was making were brand new, she had to make brand new synthetic DNA that encoded them. She put them into bacteria, and the bacteria produced the proteins. And then she could determine whether they blocked the venom from killing animals.
Okay, so the algorithm gives you possible proteins that would work. And like, how many outputs do you get? Is it like 10, 3, 1,000?
You get many thousands, but you can't test all of the designs that the computer suggests. And so Susana developed a way of selecting a smaller subset of designs to test. And she tested about 100 designs for each venom, in some cases less. And she was able to find amongst those brand new proteins invented by the AI, very potent inhibitors of the toxin.
Do they always work, like right off the shelf like that?
Well, no, because many designs don't work at all. They're kind of, it's a computer fantasy, but they don't actually work in the real world. And sometimes they work, but they don't work well enough. They don't stick tightly enough to the venom. And so then what Susana did in those cases was to carry out a second round of design where you basically tell the AI, generate new proteins that look like this one, but aren't exactly the same. And then it will kind of explore that region of that new protein it invented. And generally, when that is done, you find much better, much tighter binders than what you do in the first round.
Cesar, your focus is on discovering new antibiotics. Tell me your process.
Yeah, so in our case, about a decade ago, we wanted to introduce computational methods in our ability to discover new antibiotics. And typically, using traditional methods to come up with new antibiotics, it's a really physical process. You go around nature, and you take soil samples or water samples, and then you try to purify active compounds from all of that complex organic matter. As you can imagine, this is a process that is very reliant on trial and error experimentation. So instead of doing that, we proposed, why not take advantage of the decades worth of biological data that we have at our disposal in the form of genomes, proteomes, metagenomes that have been sequenced, and why not try to use AI and develop the right algorithms to explore all this biological data digitally to be able to accelerate our ability to discover new antibiotics?
So I want to understand this better. Are you saying that in our genomes or in the genomes of organisms, there are genes that create natural antibiotics? I think I'm familiar with how we fight infection using T cells and B cells, but are we producing antibiotics as well?
Exactly. We're producing a lot of molecules, including proteins and including small proteins called peptides that can be used as antibiotics or as immunomodulators. So the idea here was thinking of biology as an information source. All of biology, you can conceptualize it as a bunch of code, essentially. You know, if you think about DNA, it can be thought of a bunch of nucleotide code. Or if you think about proteins and peptides, they're composed of amino acids. And so in the end, it's all code, just like the code that we use to communicate with each other through the alphabet. And so it's code that can be searched using the correct algorithms. And if we can come up with those AIs, then we can systematically and very rapidly browse through all this vast amount of genetic data to try to find new molecules.
What genomes are you looking in?
So we started by exploring the human proteome for the first time. The human proteome are essentially all the proteins encoded in our genome. And there we found thousands of new antibiotics that were previously undescribed. So we came up with this idea that perhaps we could identify similar compounds all throughout evolutionary history, and including in our closest ancestors, Neanderthals and Denisovans. So we explored their genetic code and we identified new antibiotics there, such as Neanderthalin. We had to come up with new names for all these new molecules because they had not really been described before.
Neanderthalin is a great name. Like, I can hear the drug commercial in my mind.
Yeah, and then we don't only do the AI work or the computational work, but we also do all the experimental work. So then the computer gives us a number of sequences, which is essentially code. And then we have these chemical robots that can make these small peptides. Basically, we tell them, you know, make this sequence of amino acids, and the robots are capable of making that particular compound in the laboratory. And then we can actually test all those molecules against real bacteria that are clinically relevant that we have access to in my lab. And then if those work, and if we do toxicity studies and the toxicity profiles look good, we can go to preclinical infection models, which is what we've done with Neanderthalin and many, many other compounds that we found all across the tree of life.
So you are resurrecting extinct proteins.
In some cases, we are. In some cases, we don't see any homology, meaning we can't find them in any living organism in the biological world today. So in those particular instances, we are sort of resurrecting them, if you will, using chemistry in the lab. And we've gone beyond ancient humans. We've also developed a new AI model that we call APEX that enables us to actually sample every single extinct organism known to science. And so this APEX model has enabled us to discover new antibiotic compounds in ancient penguins, magnolia trees that disappear throughout evolution, and also even the woolly mammoth or giant sloths.
David and Cesar, you both have been in this world using AI for biology, using AI to sort of create these new proteins, to search for antibiotics. Did either of you encounter any skepticism when you were just starting out?
Well, yes. We when we first started trying to design new proteins completely from scratch with new functions, it seemed really crazy because the only proteins that humans knew about were the proteins that have come down through nature, through evolution. It's kind of like the ancient elven runes that have these magical properties. You know, natural proteins have these complicated names and they're very exotic. And so the idea that you could make brand new proteins up on the computer that would actually solve hard problems seemed kind of crazy. And indeed, for a long time, we couldn't make proteins that were very good at anything. But particularly with the latest generation of AI methods that we've developed, now the proteins we can make are actually, they're starting to look more and more interesting. So I would say we've gone from a situation where I would say kind of we were on the lunatic fringe and everyone thought it was crazy to now kind of in the mainstream. It's a little bit weird. Everyone's talking about the protein design revolution and their companies starting up every day to try and design new proteins. So it's really come full circle, or maybe 180 degrees, I guess I should say.
Cesar?
Yeah, we also faced a lot of skepticism initially. I remember when I got recruited to MIT to do my postdoc, I originally proposed this idea that we could maybe create an antibiotic on the computer. And at the time, MIT was a mecca for AI research, but most people were applying AI systems to pattern recognition algorithms, things like recognizing faces and sounds. But the idea of applying it to biology or to antibiotic discovery seemed kind of crazy at the time. The general consensus was that it was impossible, that biology was just too complex, too chaotic. There were too many variables for an algorithm to be of any use. And perhaps because maybe I was younger at the time, I sort of ignored that skepticism. And I continued, you know, with my collaborators and my colleagues working on this area. And we were able to actually design an antibiotic on the computer that, when synthesized, it was capable of killing some of the most dangerous pathogens in our society. And then we showed that it could reduce infections in preclinical mouse models. And so that was the beginning of convincing ourselves and others that this could be a whole new area of research where we could do antibiotic design and antibiotic discovery using machines.
And none of these antibiotics have made it to the drugstore yet. What will it take to get them there?
Not yet. I think what we've been able to do so far with AI is really dramatically accelerate our ability to discover new antibiotics. So instead of having to wait for years with traditional methods, which, you know, it can take more than the time that it takes to complete a PhD program to come up with some candidates. Today on the computer, we can discover hundreds of thousands of candidates within a few hours. So just on any given day, just to give you a sense.
Hundreds of thousands of candidates in a few hours?
In a few hours. So it's quite remarkable. So on any given day, like this morning, for example, I came into the lab, I had a cup of coffee, and, you know, by lunchtime, my team has already told me that we have thousands of new molecules to sort through. And by dinner time, we're going to have a lot more. And so it's an amazing playground for a scientist like myself that has been dreaming about really coming up with new antibiotics for so long. And now with AI, for the last several years, we've been able to really help dramatically accelerate discovery.
David, you're using AI to design good things, to help humanity. But would it be, you know, equally easy to use these algorithms to design bad stuff, like a bioweapon or something like that?
It could be, but for better, well, for worse, I guess I should say, nature has already perfected ways of doing bad things. If you take something like Ebola virus or the 1918 Spanish flu, whose sequence is now publicly available, you know, it has this amazing and incredibly dangerous ability to, you know, infect a person and then spread in a population. And that involves many, many different biological functions that individually are quite a challenge to design. So I think currently, and for the foreseeable future, the methods I'm describing are going to be much more powerfully deployed to combat nature's pandemic viruses and perhaps bioweapons. Because there's plenty of stuff that's bad already out in biology. What we don't have are good ways to protect against viruses, for example.
David, what's your bluest of blue sky ideas for using this approach?
Well, I have a lot of them. And one of the fun things now with the rest of the world now using our methods to do sort of the easier design problems, we're really focusing on the bluer sky problems. But I'll give you an example of one of them. What if we could design nanomachines that could circulate in our bodies and use a fuel that was present in our diet? So for example, a triglyceride or something else that might be part of your diet. And that nanomachine would do things like unclog arteries, you know, untangle amyloid plaques, basically be a much more active cleaner upper than current drugs are. Current protein medicines are things like antibodies, which just bind to a target and block an interaction. But what if we could make medicines that actually actively reconstruct and fix damaged tissue and perhaps could help with some of the problems in aging?
Wow. Cesar, where do you think this field's going to be in 5 years, or where do you hope it will be?
Well, my greatest dream is hopefully some of the things that we've come up with can transition into the clinic and eventually help people. That's what really drives us every single day to do the work that we do. I think one thing perhaps for the future is that we need better data sets to train AI models. We want to see really an explosion of successful story of AI in biology and in chemistry. We're going to need really good, standardized, high-quality data sets. And I've been talking to NSF and NIH to try to convince them to maybe start funding data set generation projects, not only hypothesis-driven projects, in order to be able to train the next AI models that will continue fueling this revolution.
Just echoing what Cesar said about the importance of data sets, the work we've done on designing new protein rests entirely on the really hard work done by generations of graduate students and postdocs and scientists solving protein structures and putting them in the protein structure databank. So they're really the unsung heroes of the advances in AI for protein design and protein structure prediction, because that they generated the really high quality data that the protein design methods, for example, that I described were trained on.
You know, every crucial decision in my lab, it takes into account the recommendation from the machine, but also the recommendation made by the human scientists that actually generate the data and then can inform decisions made by the algorithm.
Yeah, that's very true. In our case, I mean, we have to decide what problem to try to solve, and that's very much a human decision. And then the AI will generate some number of solutions, and then you have to decide which ones you're going to test. That's a human decision. You have to make them in the lab. That's a human action. And then you have to decide what to do with them once they work, and that's a human decision as well.
It's really a tight collaboration between humans and machines at this point.
A tight collaboration for now, anyway.
Yes.
For now.
Yes.
For now, we're still very helpful.
Yes.
Thank you both for taking time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Cesar de la Fuente, bioengineer and presidential associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Nobel laureate Dr. David Baker, director of the Institute for Protein Design and professor at the University of Washington in Seattle. After the break, how not just to survive winter, but thrive in it. Stick around. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
And I'm Flora Lichtman. Ira, we are in the winter doldrums right now. The days are short. It is so cold here in New York.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I do not love it.
No one loves it.
Are you a winter person? Do you have strategies to get through the winter?
You know, I developed a strategy when I was going to school in Buffalo. And you know what those winters are like. It is so windy. It is so cold. And you know what? I figured out if you turn backwards, you walk backwards into the wind with your parka over your head, it actually helps.
You're never going to see my eyes again because I'm just everywhere I go, I'm going to be backwards. And you know what I learned this week is that there are actually scientifically supported things you can do to better cope with winter. Our next guest traveled to some of the coldest, darkest places on Earth to learn how people there don't just survive, but thrive in winter. And one of the key ingredients is a positive wintertime mindset. Joining me to tell us more is Dr. Carrie Leibowitz, health psychologist and author of How to Winter, Harness Your Mindset to Thrive on Cold, Dark, or Difficult Days. She's based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Welcome to the show, Carrie.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Have you always been a winter lover?
No, I'm here with you today as a reformed winter hater, actually.
That's a relief.
Yeah. Right. So there's, you know, I think hope out there for you out there if you're feeling like this can never be you, because I thought it could never be me for a long time. I grew up at the Jersey Shore, which is a beach town. And, you know, summer reigned supreme and winter was the season that you just have to get through in between the best times of the year. And I really struggled with the winter growing up, really did not like the feeling of being cold, really had a hard time getting up, especially for school in the winter, in the darkness, but also really feel like I was steeped in a culture that was very celebratory of summer, and where sort of the general assumption was like, yeah, winter is depressing.
Yeah, there was a bias.
Totally. Yeah. Huge bias.
So you were converted by your own research.
I was converted by my own research and by my experience moving to Northern Norway, which was a thing that I did mostly on purpose, but also, you know, sort of like applied to do a research study in the Arctic to understand how people there make it through these very long, dark winters with relatively low rates of winter depression, and sort of, you know, never really actually expected to get the grant funding to go. And then I got it and I was like, oh my God, what have I done? Like, am I really gonna blow up my life and move to this place? And also, how will I survive this Arctic winter?
But you did.
I did, and I learned a lot, and that was, you know, where my reformation really took place, was in Northern Norway, where I was exposed to, I mean, both a very special winter. I think, you know, Northern Norway is a very magical winter wonderland, but also was exposed to a culture and a perspective where people were really doing things to embrace the season, really looking at winter differently, really approaching it differently, and where I learned a lot of lessons that, you know, even in places with perhaps slightly less magical winters that I have lived since then, I've been able to take with me, you know, through to other kinds of winters.
Yeah, I mean, I would have expected if you go to the Arctic, you would find widespread misery in the winter. But that is not what you found.
If you look at lots of places in the world, including Norway and Northern Norway, including Iceland, including the Netherlands, they actually tend to have lower rates of seasonal affective disorder than we would expect. And so it's clear that people all over the world who live through these very extreme, long, dark winters are able to do so without a lot of the winter depression that sort of paradoxically we see at, you know, lower latitudes and milder climates.
Carrie, what is their secret?
Okay, I mean, there's a lot of things, I think, but, you know, part of the secret is that I think they have a really different mindset and approach to the season. And so a big part of what that looks like is this willingness to adapt to winter. So I almost think there's an advantage of having a really extreme winter, because when you live in a place like where I was living in Norway, where the sun actually doesn't rise for 2 months, it's obvious that that is going to affect you, and it's obvious that you can and should change your behavior to adjust to that. It's okay that you feel more tired in the winter, duh, because the sun isn't rising and you're in the Arctic, so obviously you're going to dress appropriately for the winter weather, whereas I think people, you know, at more middle latitudes, we try to pretend like we can just carry on the same as in other seasons, like winter sort of shouldn't affect us. And so I think it's both our perspective and our approach. And of course, I also think there's a lot of cultural things and infrastructure in places that are really built for winter that enable people to embrace the season differently, as well as sort of, you know, their individual mindsets and perspectives.
And we're going to get into all that. We asked our listeners for their wintertime survival strategies. And first of all, I have to say, Michigan, Wisconsin, Upper Midwest was out in force for this one, as we might expect. And a lot of the strategies we heard were Nordic inspired. So here's a clip.
My name is Shannon Mitchell from Grand Haven, Michigan. And how do I get through the lake effect darky winters that we have here? I have adopted a Finnish lifestyle from my experiences up in the Kiwanis, which is saunas, cold plunges, Nordic skiing. And when the sun is out, it's guns out, no matter what the situation is.
I mean, this is both exemplifies this idea that we can really learn from the Nordics and apply it to wherever we are. But also, you know, what I like about these strategies is that they work with the season to find the opportunities in winter, right? What things are better in the winter?
A cold plunge? I don't know.
A cold plunge. Well, a cold plunge you can really only do in the winter.
True.
And so the question is, what seasonal activities can you give yourself in winter to look forward to annually?
Let me run another listener strategy by you. What do you think about this one?
Okay.
Hi, this is Tony in Charlotte, North Carolina. and I'm sitting in a Chick-fil-A parking lot having my peppermint shake. That's one help. It's starting to snow, but my most regular thing that I go to is a nice cup of tea and the Hallmark Channel. It seems to help quite a bit.
Tony, you and my mom are birds of a feather. Cup of tea and the Hallmark Channel, like you could be in my house any day in December. But, you know, I think what's special about the Hallmark Channel, right, is it's this seasonal ritual that you look forward to. It's such a small ritual. And so many of these ways of embracing winter is like they sound trivial. They're basic. But when you do that with a little bit of intention, this is one of those strategies that takes on an outsized meaning because it transforms something that we usually feel is unpleasant or uncomfortable or a negative of the cold and makes it into an opportunity for this other kind of sensory pleasure that is small but comforting.
No, it's so true. I mean, hot frosty does work better in December than in July.
Yeah, you can't watch Hot Frosty in July. Like, get out of here.
All right, let me run another listener message by you.
Hi, this is Dee from North Manchester. And I was sharing how I make it through the winter. I'm 72, so I've made it through several. Every fall, I plant more daffodils in the ground, and then I just wait impatiently for them to sprout in the spring. And it's always something to look forward to.
Yes, I love this one also, Dee. I mean, this one does two things, right? So it gives Dee something to do in the fall as the days are getting shorter, which is a time that I think many people sort of consciously or unconsciously have sort of winter panic, you know, like the days are getting shorter, we're going into it, we're like, oh no, here we go. And so an activity that is seasonal to that time of year can really counteract that. And then the other thing it does is it gives Dee a marker of early springtime. Hmm. So one of the strategies that I really love is the Sami, who are the indigenous people of northern Scandinavia, actually have 8 seasons. So they have winter, spring, summer, fall, and also 4 bridge seasons. So spring, summer, summer, fall, fall, winter, and spring, winter. And I think spring, winter is a really handy subseason to sort of separate out in our hearts and minds, because often depending on where you live, anytime between, you know, mid-February to late April, early May, you're sort of in this transition period where maybe mentally you're over the winter, you're kind of done with it, and you get that first warm day of spring and you're like, that's it, I'm putting my coat away, like I'm done. And then the next day it's cold again, you know? And it's not spring, but it's not winter. It's spring winter.
I love spring winter, and actually having you name it really does bring me to a very, very specific memories of it. I almost can smell it, like that petrichor, that sort of like earth smell that comes back when the ground isn't frozen anymore. And I can see my front yard where there's a lot of little crocuses popping through. And it's interesting that just giving it the name somehow then carves it out in my own mind.
Totally. I mean, you know, I think having the language to describe these things is really powerful. And I think this is even, you know, the whole power of talking about your wintertime mindset. You know, you already had a wintertime mindset before it was named for you. But when it's called out and you have a word for it, you can start noticing it and paying attention to it and experiencing it differently.
Yeah, I want to talk more about this positive wintertime mindset. Is this like snowflake pilling ourselves? Like we just, how do you define it?
So, you know, I use that word very specifically. So we think of mindsets as sort of the core assumption about something in the world and how it works. And so the truth is that lots of things in the world are ambiguous, right? Like stress is a good example. Stress can be harmful for our health and well-being, but it also can be helpful for our performance and our health and well-being, right? The stress response evolved to help us meet our goals. And so when we encounter stress, what is our mindset about it and how does that determine something like stress's impact on us? And you can think about that with winter as well. So winter has objective qualities. Winter is objectively dark, cold, usually wet, but the meaning of cold, dark, and wet is very ambiguous. Cold, dark, and wet can be refreshing, rejuvenating, cozy, magical.
That never occurred to me until you just said it.
To most people, but really it can be if you let it be.
We had a listener who left us a message, and when I heard it, I was like, yes, this listener has the positive wintertime mindset. Listen to this.
Hello, my name is Cody. So I, typically living on the Oregon coast, we get all sorts of overcast. It is pretty oppressive for a lot of people. Me, though, I don't know if I'm a vampire, but I just soak it up. Winter is my favorite time.
Yeah, so I think Cody has the positive wintertime mindset. Some people just sort of like that overcast or inherently feel that it is cozy. But I think even if you're not naturally like Cody, it's a thing that you can train yourself to appreciate a little bit.
Okay, and let me run another listener's coping mechanism by you.
Hi, this is Dan in Bear Lake, Michigan. I adopted a couple dogs. They love the snow and they truly love it when I get outside with them. So they're helping me a lot in not just coping with, but enjoying winter.
What do you think?
I mean, I think dogs are good for everything. And
can't go wrong with a dog.
Right. I mean, a dog is a really great motivator for getting outside. But I also think, you know, there's something so pure, right, about a kid's relationship to the snow or a dog's relationship to the snow. You're just experiencing the fun of it is something we can learn from dogs.
Let's talk about seasonal affective disorder. How many folks actually fit the diagnosis for that?
So seasonal affective disorder is really interesting because I think there's a lot of popular misconceptions about it. I think a lot of people think that it is a mild form of depression, that it is sort of a lower threshold than clinical depression. But the truth is that seasonal affective disorder is a subtype of clinical depression. So you first have to meet the criteria of clinical depression. It has to severely disrupt your quality of life and your daily functioning. And I think a lot of people have the experience of feeling affected by winter, of feeling like they're more tired in the winter or they're less motivated, they have less energy, they feel less social. And actually, we can see that as a natural and normal response to the seasonal changes in light. You know, if you look at every other living thing on earth, plant or animal, they're all changing their behavior or slowing down in some way in the winter. You know, a lot of the times when people have this feeling like, oh, I'm so tired in the winter, what's wrong with me? It's almost because we've pathologized having any response to winter and we're so hesitant to adapt to the season that we're quick to label it winter depression when in fact it might not be.
Carrie, it seems like we have a lot of shorthand for this like negative view of winter, you know, winter doldrums, winter blues. Do we need a new shorthand for winter, like winter whoopies, glacial giddies? Brainstorm with me here, Carrie.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, let's be the winter PR team, you know? I think winter wonder, winter wellness, you know? It doesn't maybe have to be alliterative,
It has to be. Okay, listeners, we know, listeners, you're the cleverest among us. We want your thoughts on this. Call us with your winter rebranding and let's get a movement going. 646-767-6532. Give us a positive winter catchphrase. 646-767-6532. Get your pencils. 646-767-6532. Carrie, thank you so much for the polar positivity today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I can't wait to hear what the listeners come up with. It's going to be great.
Dr. Carrie Leibowitz, health psychologist and author of How to Winter, Harness Your Mindset to Thrive on Cold, Dark, or Difficult Days. Carrie's based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And you can join us throughout the week on social media or with our newsletters. Head to sciencefriday.com/newsletters or email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. See you next week. I'm Flora Lichtman.